This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be made available in podcast after the broadcast. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of A Lesson Before Dying using a cast of volunteer readers. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138. This is the final installment of A Lesson Before Dying. We will complete Chapter 30 and then read Chapter 31. Thereafter, we will listen to the music in its entirety. The name of the tune we've been hearing is Marcus Hernan's Air. It was recorded by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. That will have us at about the 45-minute mark. Thereafter, we'll complete the hour with a little bit of commentary and some information about the author. Thanks again for joining us.
At 6:30, the sheriff sat down at the table in his dining room to eat his breakfast. His breakfast was two homemade biscuit sandwiches. The biscuits had been split open. One contained a pork sausage patty, and the other contained figs. Lillian, their colored maid, had preserved figs the past summer. The sheriff also drank a glass of milk and a cup of strong coffee. Usually the sheriff ate his breakfast at 8 o'clock and arrived at the jail at 9, but he wanted to get there no later than 7:30 today because that chair was supposed to arrive by 8. The sheriff's wife sat across the table from him drinking coffee. It was too early in the morning for her to eat anything. As the sheriff ate, he talked to his wife, but he avoided looking at her directly in the face most of the time. He told her that he wished this day had never gotten here, but now that it had, he had to do what he had to do. This was the first time he was in charge of an execution, and he was praying that everything would go well. He told his wife that he had asked the teacher if he wanted to be there, but the teacher had shaken his head. He understood, he had said to the teacher. The reverend had asked to be there, and he had asked the reverend if one other person from the quarter would like to be there, too. The reverend said he would ask, and the next day the reverend came in and told him that Harry Williams had said yes. The sheriff knew Harry Williams and knew he was no troublemaker. The sheriff ate his food and looked beyond his wife as he mentioned the names of other witnesses. He had also hired two more deputies to be there today, just in case he needed them. Two people from Mr. Gropey's family were going to be there, and he thanked God that the family had let him handle this in a civilized way. He told his wife, without looking directly at her, that it would take place in the storeroom on the bottom floor in the back of the courthouse. He said everything had been cleared out of the room so there would be space for the chair and the witnesses. Malvina Jack was sweeping off the sidewalk at Edwin's department store when the truck went by her. She had finished and was knocking the dust out of the broom when she saw the truck turn down the alley beside the courthouse. Juanita Dijon, one of the white clerks in the store, came outside and asked Malvina if she had any idea what was inside that truck. Malvina did not, and Juanita told her that she would know before this day was over. An automobile drove up and parked in front of the courthouse in a space marked Official. The sheriff's car was already parked in his personal parking space. Two men got out of the official car and went inside the courthouse. The older, heavier man wore a cowboy hat, and both men wore suits. Malvina and Juanita continued to watch the truck parked beside the courthouse. Then, suddenly, Malvina's heart started pumping extra fast, and Juanita heard her say, "No, no, yes, yes," she heard Juanita say. While they stood there watching the truck, Sheriff Guidry came out of the courthouse with the two men, and the three of them went around the side to the truck. Sheriff Guidry said something to the driver, and the truck moved toward the rear of the courthouse, up against a window. Two men got out of the cab of the truck and climbed up onto the bed and began rolling back the tarpaulin cover. Then Melvina saw it, a high-backed wooden chair with leather straps, and it took all her strength, she said later, to remain on her feet. The two men, one on either side, moved the chair to the tailgate of the truck, and two other men, who had come out of the back of the courthouse, stood on the ground with their arms extended as the chair was eased down to them. When the men on the ground had the chair secured in their hands, the two men in the truck jumped down to the ground, and the four of them took the chair through the door into the courthouse. There was something else in the truck, a machine-looking thing, Melvina said. Juanita told her that nothing would happen until 12 o'clock, and that she could go home at 11:30 if she wanted to. Melvina thanked her, but still she could not take her eyes off the truck. She heard Juanita saying that she wished something like this could be done somewhere else. What about those poor children up at the school? She just hoped they would not hear that thing. Melvina knew she was speaking of the white children at the white school, but she had no idea what it was that could be heard as far away as the school was from the courthouse. During the month that he was in jail, Fee Jenkins' duty was to clean the sheriff's office and the white men's and the white ladies' restrooms. He started every morning between 6 and 6:30 and finished around 8 or a little after. He was just getting ready to put away the mop and bucket when he saw them bringing that chair in through the back door. 4 people were carrying it, 2 strangers and the 2 special deputies, Oscar and Claude Guerin. The sheriff walked in front, and a man wearing a cowboy hat followed the chair. The man with the cowboy hat kept saying, "Be careful, be careful." He didn't want that chair bumping into anything. The sheriff opened the door to the old storeroom, and the 2 strangers took it inside, then everyone followed. They did not shut the door, and Fee could hear them talking in there, though from where he was in the hall he could not see them. He could hear the sheriff asking where the chair should be set, and the man in the cowboy hat was saying he wanted it against the wall, not far from the window, because those wires from the generator on the truck had to come through the window. Other people who had come to work were also in the corridor. A woman was saying that she had seen it, and it looked just gruesome. A man said it did look gruesome, and that's why they called it Gruesome Gertie. The man told the woman that whoever sat in Gruesome Gertie's lap when she was hot never sat down again. The woman replied, "That is gruesome." Fee heard the man with the cowboy hat tell someone to go out to the truck and bring in the instruments. A white man standing behind Fee asked him if he had seen it. Fee said he surely had, and it looked mean. The white man told Fee he had better watch himself, or maybe they would have to bring Gertie back for him to sit in her lap. Another man laughed nervously. A woman in the hall told the man, "Shame on him. He ought to stop that. Just shame on him." Fee could hear the man with the cowboy hat talking to another man through the window. He was asking the man, "Did everything reach okay?" And the man out on the truck said, "Yes, everything did." Out in the corridor, more people were coming in for work. They all wanted to know if the first ones there had seen it. Some of them who had not seen it said they had. Someone said if you had not seen it, you would most definitely hear it. And a woman said she wished she had played sick and stayed home today. A man told her that anyone who wanted to leave was free to stay away between 12 and 3. The woman said she was not going to be anywhere around here. Someone asked, "Was it always between 12 and 3? And another man said, "Yes, it always was." Someone else said, "The Lord died between 12 and 3 on a Friday." A woman said, "Yes, and so did 2 thieves, one on either side of him." Fee heard the woman saying that she definitely was not going to be here during that time. She said she felt sick already. Clay Lemon, who worked at Weber's Cafe and Bar and Bait Shop, and who ran errands for Felix Weber, had just gotten out of the car to go into the bank where he first heard the noise. The sound was coming from the direction of the courthouse, a block and a half away. Clay said later that he did not know what it was, nor did he know exactly where it was coming from. A white man and a white woman walking ahead of him were just about to go into the bank when the woman stopped suddenly and looked back. She said, "Oh, God, don't tell me that they've started." And the man said, "Come on, dear, come on, don't listen to that." The man held the door open for the woman, but she would not go inside, and Clay would not dare go through the door until the white people did. The man told the woman that nothing was going to happen until after 12 o'clock, and they would be long gone by then. He said that they were just warming up the thing, testing those instruments to make sure everything was in working order. The woman said, "But my God, the whole town can hear that thing." The man said, "Come on, come on, dear," and put his arm around her. They went inside, and Clay followed. The woman asked the clerk behind the counter if she had heard it. The clerk asked, "Heard what?" The woman told about the noise that was coming from the courthouse. The clerk said that being inside, they heard very little from that far away. The woman shook her head and said, "It was just horrible, just too horrible." The clerk told the woman that her little boy had asked her last night what was going to happen at the jail today, and she said that the sheriff just had to put an old bad nigger away, and she didn't want him to worry about anything. The clerk said that she checked on her little boy just before she went to bed that night. He was sound asleep. And today, when he left for school with his little book sack, there was not a solitary word. He'd forgotten all about it. The clerk said all this while serving the white woman and white man. Then Clay stepped up to the counter, but he had forgotten why he was there. The clerk, who was very thin with blonde hair and gray-blue eyes, looked at him and said, Well, I don't have all day. Didn't you bring it? But Clay didn't know what she was talking about. "Didn't Felix send you here to get the money, you dumbbell?" she asked him. He must have given her the sack with the note and the check, because the next thing he knew he had the weight of quarters, nickels, dimes, and pennies in the sack, and he was outside again in the bright sunlight, and he could still hear the noise from the generator a block and a half away. Paul was in his office when the sheriff and the executioner came in, followed by the two special deputies, Claude and Oscar Guerin. The sheriff sat behind his desk and motioned for the executioner, whose name was Henry Vincent, to have a seat. Vincent took off his cowboy hat and hung it on the rack beside the sheriff's cowboy hat. Paul noticed that the hair on top of Vincent's head was not as gray as the sideburns were. The sheriff asked Vincent if he wanted some coffee, and Vincent said yes. The sheriff told Oscar to go down the hall and get that pot of coffee and bring back some cups. Vincent asked the sheriff if the prisoner had been shaved. The sheriff said no. Vincent asked the sheriff if he didn't think it was about time. The sheriff looked at Paul standing by the window. He told Paul where the things were. He should get Murphy out of the cell and have him do it. Vincent instructed Paul to make sure Murphy did it right, shaved him close. He pointed to the areas on the leg and wrist. He said electrodes had to be attached there as well as to the head, and all that had to be shaved very clean. The sheriff told the executioner that the prisoner had hardly any hair on his body other than on his head. Vincent told Paul that Murphy must shave the prisoner everywhere. He told him to. Electricity sometimes found hair that the naked eye would never see. He said that this was an execution, not torture, that he had seen enough of that for a lifetime. Paul asked the sheriff if someone else couldn't do this. The sheriff told him that Clark would not be there until later, and that he had to do it. Paul nodded for Claude Guerin to come with him, and they went into the next room. He could hear Vincent asking the sheriff if he thought Paul was all right, and the sheriff saying that he was, but this was his first time. Vincent told the sheriff that all they needed was for one of their own men to come apart. The sheriff assured him that Paul was okay, but that this was his first time, that's all. Vincent told the sheriff he hoped he knew his men. Paul and Claude left through another door, Claude carrying a wash basin, clippers, scissors, and a safety razor. People came out of their offices to ask Paul if it was time yet. The special deputy told them that it was only hair-cutting time. A man standing at one of the office doors said, oh, yes, he had heard they got a haircut first. Someone else said, what an experience, what an experience. You didn't get to witness this every day. Paul and Claude went up to the cell block and unlocked Murphy's cell and told him they had a job for him to do. Murphy looked at the things in Claude's hands and asked, why him? Because the sheriff said so, Paul told him. Murphy came out and the three of them went down to the last cell. Jefferson had been lying on his back, but he sat up and looked at them when they came in. He didn't seem frightened. He appeared tired. Paul could see how red his eyes were and knew that he had not slept at all. Paul asked him how he felt, and he said he was all right. He wore a blue denim shirt and denim trousers. His laceless shoes were halfway under the bunk. The radio and the notebook were on the floor beside the wall. The radio was silent. A bird sang in the sycamore tree outside the window. Paul told Jefferson that he had to have his head shaved. He sent Murphy to get warm water and a piece of soap from the shower room. While Murphy was gone, Paul and the other deputy stood near the unlocked cell door. Jefferson sat on the bunk, leaning forward and staring down at the floor. The two deputies watched him, but no one said anything. The bird continued its chirping in the tree outside the window. Jefferson turned to look at the deputy standing beside Paul and asked him, "How was Miss Bernice?" Claude didn't know whether he should answer until Paul nodded, and Claude told him that his wife was okay. "And little Roy?" Jefferson wanted to know. Claude looked at Paul, and Paul nodded again. "Little Roy was all right, too. He was at school." Jefferson looked down at the floor. Murphy came back with a wash basin of warm water and a piece of white soap. He set the basin of water on the floor at the foot of the bunk and took the clippers from Claude Guérin. Claude tried not to meet Jefferson's eyes when Jefferson looked up at him. The two deputies stood back by the door and watched as the layers of hair fell to the floor. When Murphy had finished with the clippers, he dipped his hand into the basin of warm water and started rubbing Jefferson's head with the piece of white soap. Claude handed him the safety razor. When the head was shaved, black and shining, Paul instructed Murphy to take the scissors and cut Jefferson's trouser legs and shirt sleeves. He stood over Murphy and pointed out the areas around the ankles and wrists where he wanted him to shave. All this time, Jefferson obeyed as if he were in a trance, as if he felt nothing. When Murphy was finished, he stood back and examined his work. But Jefferson was looking down at the floor. Paul asked him if he needed anything, and when he did not answer, the deputy motioned for Claude and Murphy to leave. He followed and locked the cell door. As he was about to walk away, Jefferson raised his head and looked at him. He told Paul that he wanted him to bring me the notebook and that he wanted Paul to have the radio. Paul told him he couldn't take the radio, but he would give it to the other inmates for use in the day room if Jefferson didn't mind. Jefferson asked Paul if he wanted the marble that Bach had given him, and Paul told him that he would accept the marble. He told Paul to be sure that Mr. Henri got the pocket knife and the little gold chain. Paul said he would see to that. Jefferson continued to look at Paul, a long, deep look, and the deputy felt that there was something else he wanted to say. Murphy and the other deputy were still waiting. "Well," Paul said, and started to walk away. "Paul," Jefferson said quietly, and his eyes were speaking even more than his mouth. The deputy looked back at him. Murphy and Claude did too. "You gonna be there, Paul?" Jefferson asked, his eyes asked. Paul nodded. "Yes, Jefferson, I'll be there."
Chapter 31. After the students had recited their Bible verses, and before classes began, I told them that there would be no recess period for them today, and that I would let them go home for dinner at 11 o'clock, because I wanted them all back at school no later than 11:45. I told them that at exactly 12 o'clock, they would all get down on their knees and remain on their knees until I heard from the courthouse, whether that took an hour, an hour and a half, or 3 hours. Louis Washington, Jr. stuck up a grimy little hand. "Suppose somebody got to be excused." "Then he'll make up that time on his knees after 3 o'clock," I told him. "For every minute that you don't spend on your knees between 12 o'clock and until I hear from that courthouse, you will spend twice that time on your knees after 3. Any other questions?" "No, sir." "Does anyone else have a question?" No one did. "All right. Open those books, and I want silence and I mean silence. I assigned Odessa Freeman primer and first grades. Irene Cole would teach second and third. Fourth graders opened their books to English grammar. Fifth graders, geography. Sixth, history. I told them I would test them later, if not this afternoon, then definitely tomorrow morning. I knew I would not be able to concentrate on teaching this morning, so I got my Westcott ruler and went outside. It was a nice day. Blue sky, not a cloud. Across the road in the Freeman's yard, I could see a patch of white lilies on either side of the walk that led up to the porch. An old automobile tire surrounded each flower. Behind the house was the sugarcane field. The new cane was about waist high to the average man walking between the rows. Somewhere across the field, I could hear the sound of a tractor. A white sharecropper must have been plowing the ground, since no colored people were working today. Even those who worked up at the big house for Henri Pichot or other white people along the river had taken the day off. This had been discussed and agreed at church last Sunday. Those who were not at church were told what the others had decided, that he, Jefferson, should have all their respect this one day. Now, except for the sound of the tractor back in the field, the rest of the plantation was quiet. No one sat out on the porch, no one worked in the garden, no one walked across the yard or in the road. I looked toward Miss Emma's house, farther down the quarter. My aunt was there. Others were there, but they were all inside. The front door was shut, though the window was open to let in fresh air. I could see the white gauze curtain hanging limp in the window. I went around to the back of the church. Like so many country churches, it was wood-framed, long and narrow, with a corrugated tin roof and a bell tower. Years ago, I was told, the church sat flat on the ground. Later, it was set up on wooden blocks. During the 30s, when I was a student here, the wooden blocks, which had rotted over the years, were replaced by bricks. A year or two before I started teaching, Farrell Giroux and a couple of other men removed the bricks and put in cement blocks. But now even the cement blocks had sunk so low to the ground that a child losing a marble or a ball under the church had a hard time crawling under there to retrieve it. I remember playing ragball there, the other children and I using our fists as bats. We all tried to hit the ball out of the yard for a home run. I supposed I had done so as many times as anyone else, but the number of times was nothing to brag about. Where were all the others now? Most had gone. To southern cities, to northern cities, others to the grave. Had Jefferson ever hit a home run? He was as big as anyone else, stronger than most, but to hit a home run off a rag ball was a feat. Brute strength was not enough. Timing and luck were needed. You had to hit it just right, and that took timing and luck. Lily Green hit as many as anyone else, I supposed, but her luck ran out before she was 20, killed accidentally in a bar room in Baton Rouge. What a waste. Such a beautiful girl. All the boys loved Lily Green. I started back toward the front. What about tomorrow? What happens after today? Nothing will ever be the same after today. At 11:05, I was standing at my desk, facing the open front door, when I saw the minister's car go up the quarter, with Henry Williams sitting in the passenger seat beside him. They were on their way into Bayonne. I told my students to put their things away quietly. Before letting them go, I reminded them that I didn't want any running or loud talking, and that I wanted them all back at school no later than 11:45. When they had gone, I sat down at my desk, facing the door. I did not want time to think. I wanted to sit there until I heard, but not to think before then. No, I wanted to go to my car and drive away, to go somewhere and lose all memory of where I had come from. I wanted to go. I wanted to God, what does a person do who knows there is only one more hour to live? I felt like crying, but I refused to cry. No, I would not cry. There were too many more who would end up as he did. I could not cry for all of them. Could I? I wished I could telephone Vivian, but there was not one phone, public or otherwise, between here and Bayonne that I could use. I would see her tonight, though. I would definitely see her tonight. I need to see you tonight, my love. But who is with him? Who is with you, Jefferson? Is he with you, Jefferson? He is with Reverend Ambrose because Reverend Ambrose believes. Do you believe, Jefferson? Have I done anything to make you not believe? If I have, please forgive me for being a fool. For at this moment, what else is there? I know now that old man is much braver than I. I am not with you at this moment because I would not have been able to stand. I would not have been able to walk with you those last few steps. I would have embarrassed you. But the old man will not. He will be strong. He is going to use their God to give him strength. You just watch, Jefferson. You just watch. He is braver. Braver than I. Braver than any of them. Except you, I hope. My faith is in you, Jefferson. The children returned from dinner as I had asked them to, and at 11:50, I lined them up before the door. When the last one had marched into the church, I went to my desk to face them. In a couple of minutes, it will be 12:00. I will ask you to get down on your knees and remain on your knees until I ask you to get up. Are there any questions? Louis Washington, Jr. raised that grimy little hand again. Is you going bow down too, Mr. Wiggins? The proper way to ask that question is, are you going to bow down too, Mr. Wiggins? You going bow down too? I'll be outside, I told the class. Irene, you, Odessa, and Clarence are in charge. All right, please, on your knees. I'll tell you when to get up. We need to pray? Louis Washington, Jr. wanted to know. Yes, I told him, but quietly, to yourself. Several of the larger girls knelt on scarves or handkerchiefs. I took up my waistcoat and went out through the front door. I had no idea what I would do while I waited to hear from Bayonne, but I found myself out on the road, walking up the quarter. It was a couple of minutes after 12, and I was trying not to think. But how could I not think about something that had dominated my thoughts for nearly 6 months? It seemed that I had spent more time with him in that jail cell than I had with the children in the church school. Where was he at this very moment? At the window, looking out at the sky? Lying on the bunk, staring up at the gray ceiling? Standing at the cell door, waiting? How did he feel? Was he afraid? Was he crying? Were they coming to get him now, this moment? Was he on his knees, begging for one more minute of life? Was he standing? Why wasn't I there? Why wasn't I standing beside him? Why wasn't my arm around him? Why? Why wasn't I back there with the children? Why wasn't I down on my knees? Why? At the mouth of the quarter, there was shade from a pecan tree in the corner of the fence surrounding Henri Pichot's yard. A shallow ditch ran between the fence and the road. The people from the quarter had sat under that tree as far back as I could remember. Men had gambled there with cards and dice. Others had stood there or sat to get out of the hot sun or the rain. Before I had a car, I had stood there many times waiting for the bus. The bus driver always blew the horn about a mile before he got there, and I would have time to cross the highway to wave it down. There would always be someone there. But today, I sat alone. Behind me was Henri Pichot's gray and white antebellum house, sitting on its foundation high above the ground. His car was parked on the grass in the front yard. I figured he would be the first to hear, and maybe he would come into the quarter. I looked back over my shoulder when I sat down, and I looked back every minute or two afterward. It must have been 12:15 by now. I didn't want to look at my watch anymore. Had it already happened? Or was he still waiting? Sitting on the bunk, hands clasped together, waiting. Was he standing at the cell door, listening for the first sound of footsteps coming toward him? Or was it finally over? Don't tell me to believe. Don't tell me to believe in the same God or laws that men believe in who commit these murders. Don't tell me to believe that God can bless this country and that men are judged by their peers. Who among his peers judged him? Was I there? Was the minister there? Was Harry Williams there? Was Farrell Giroux? Was my aunt? Was Vivian? No, his peers did not judge him, and I will not believe. Yet they must believe. They must believe, if only to free the mind, if not the body. Only when the mind is free has the body a chance to be free. Yes, they must believe. They must believe, because I know what it means to be a slave. I am a slave. I looked back, but there was no movement at Henri Pichot's house. It must have been close to 12:30, but I refused to look at my watch. Several feet away from where I sat under the tree was a hill of bullgrass. I doubted that I had looked at it once in all the time I'd been sitting there. I probably would have not have noticed it at all had a butterfly, a yellow butterfly with dark specks like ink spots on its wings, not lit there. What had brought it there? There was no odor that I could detect to have attracted it. There were other places where it could have rested. There was the wire fence on the other side of the road. There were weeds along both ditches with strong fragrances. There were flowers just a short distance away in Pichot's yard. So why did it light on a hill of bullgrass that offered it nothing? I watched it closely. The way it opened its wings and closed them. The way it opened its wings again, fluttered, closed its wings for a second or two, then opened them again and flew away. I watched it fly over the ditch and down into the quarter. I watched it until I could see it no more. Yes, I told myself, it's finally over. I waited another few minutes for Henri Pichot to come out, but he did not. I stood up and stretched and looked across the highway at the river, so tranquil, its water as blue as the sky. The willows near the edge of the water were just as still, and no breeze stirred the Spanish moss that hung from the cypresses. I could hear the horn as the bus came around the big bend a mile away on its way into Bayonne. I looked toward Pichot's house again, and I started back down the quarter. I knew it was over, that I would wait until I heard from the courthouse. I looked back several times, but no Henri Pichot. I was the only person in the road, just me and my gray car parked further down the quarter, in front of my aunt's house. I took my time walking, and occasionally slapped my leg with the waistcoat. When I came up even with the church, I stopped out in the road to look at Miss Emma's house again. The door was still shut. The curtain hung limp in the window. I wondered if she knew it was finally over. Just before going into the churchyard, I looked back up the quarter. And now I did see a car coming toward me. The driver drove slowly to keep down the dust. It didn't look like Pichot's car, and I knew it was not Reverend Ambrose's. I moved into the ditch as Paul came up even with me and stopped. We looked at each other. I knew he had come to bring me the news. I didn't go up to the car as I was supposed to do. I waited for him to make his move. I saw him reach for something on the seat beside him. Then he opened the door and got out. He had a notebook, just like the one I had given Jefferson. I waited for him to come to me. He wanted me to bring you this. Paul looked directly at me, his gray-blue eyes more intense than I had ever seen them before. I took the notebook from him, and he continued to stare at me like someone in shock. "Do you have a minute?" he asked me. "Yes, but I'll have to go inside first. I left the children on their knees. I'll be right back." The children all looked at me as I walked up the aisle to the table. I told them to rise from their knees. When they had all sat down, some of them rubbing their knees before sitting, I told them I had to speak with someone, and I wanted them to remain quiet until I got back. I told them that Jefferson had sent a notebook to me, and I was going to leave it on the table, and later we would talk. I left Irene Cole in charge and went back outside. Paul and I started walking down the quarter. We were both quiet. I waited for him to begin. It went as well as it could have gone. He spoke slowly as we walked abreast, he looking up ahead, I down at the ground. There was no trouble. He was a little shaky, but no trouble. Paul was quiet a moment. Then suddenly he stopped walking. After going another step, I stopped too and looked back at him. He was the strongest man in that crowded room, Grant Wiggins, Paul said, staring at me and speaking louder than what was necessary. He was. He was. I'm not saying this to make you feel good. I'm not saying this to ease your pain. Ask that preacher. Ask Harry Williams. He was the strongest man there. We all jammed together, no more than 6-8 feet away from that chair. We all had each other to lean on. When Vincent asked him if he had any last words, he looked at the preacher and said, "Tell Nannan I walked." And straight he walked, Grant Wiggins. Straight he walked. I'm a witness. Straight he walked. Paul stopped talking. He was breathing heavily. He was looking at me, but seeing Jefferson in that chair. He started walking again. We were passing Miss Emma's house. But Paul didn't know this. He had never been in the quarter before. After they put the death cloth over his face, I couldn't watch anymore. I looked down at the floor, Paul was saying. His voice was quieter, less intense now. I heard two jolts, but I wouldn't look up. I'll never forget the sound of that generator as long as I live on this earth. We came to the end of the quarter and stood on the railroad tracks while gazing across the field at the rows of early cane. Paul got in front of me and took a look into my face. "You're one great teacher, Grant Wiggins," he said. "I'm not great. I'm not even a teacher." "Why do you say that?" "You have to believe to be a teacher," I said, looking at the rows of new cane. To the right of where we were standing, the tall pecan trees in the cemetery. There would be another grave there within a day or two. "I saw the transformation, Grant Wiggins," Paul said. "I didn't do it." "Who, then?" "Maybe he did it himself." "He could never have done that. I saw the transformation. I'm a witness to that." "Then maybe it was God," I said. Paul continued to look at me. He did not like the way I had used the name of God. He came from good stock. He believed. He didn't say anything. "You're ready to start back?" I asked him. "I didn't open his notebook," Paul said. We had turned and were walking up the quarter now. I didn't think it was my place to open the notebook. He asked me to bring it to you, and I brought it to you. But I would like to know his thoughts sometime, if you don't mind. "After I read it," I said. "I suppose this has been hard on everybody." "Hard on the people here," I said. School is just about ready to end, huh? Paul asked after a while. Yes, I said. We start a month later and get out 2 months earlier than the whites do. What are you going to do when school is over? Go on a vacation? I don't know. It depends on Vivian. Whatever she wants. She's beautiful, Paul said. You're a lucky fellow there, Grant Wiggins. Yes, I'm lucky, I said. Some of us are. I'm sorry, Paul said. I am very, very sorry. We had stopped for a moment. Now we were walking again. If I could ever be of any help, I would like you to call on me. I mean that with all my heart. We were passing by Miss Emma's house. Reverend Ambrose's car was parked before the door. Isn't that the preacher's car? Paul asked. That's where Jefferson lived. That's his Nanon's house. Paul looked at the house as we went by. He looked at it again over his shoulder. We came up to the church and stopped at his car. Well, I better go into the children, I said. Paul stuck out his hand. Allow me to be your friend, Grant Wiggins. I don't ever want to forget this day. I don't ever want to forget him. I took his hand. He held mine with both of his. I don't know what you're going to say when you go back in there, but tell them he was the bravest man in that room today. I'm a witness, Grant Wiggins. Tell them so. Maybe one day you will come back and tell them so. It would be an honor. I turned from him and went into the church. Irene Cole told the class to rise, and with their shoulders back, I went to the desk and turned to face them. I was crying. Ernest J. Gaines was born in 1933 on the River Lake Plantation in Pointe-Coupe Parish, Louisiana, the setting for most of his fiction. He was the fifth generation in his family to be born there. At the age of 9, he was picking cotton in the plantation fields. The Black Quarter's school held classes only 5 or 6 months a year. When he was 15, Gaines moved to Florida to join his parents, who had left Louisiana during World War II. There he attended San Francisco State University and later won a writing fellowship to Stanford University. Gaines published his first short story in 1956. Since then, he has written 8 books of fiction, including Catherine Carmier, Of Love and Dust, Bloodline, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, A Long Day in November, In My Father's House, and A Gathering of Old Men, most of which are available in vintage paperback editions. A Lesson Before Dying, his most recent novel, won the 1993 National Book Critics Circle Award. He has been awarded a MacArthur Foundation grant for writings of rare historical resonance. Ernest Gaines and his wife Diane now live year-round in Oscar, Louisiana. They built a house on land that was part of the plantation where he grew up. He is now writer-in-residence emeritus at University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Gaines's father left the family early, and his mother moved to New Orleans to find work. This left the boy in the care of his disabled aunt, whose strength returns in Tanty Lou and several of Gaines's other female characters. Barely into his teens, Gaines began to write and stage steadily more ambitious plays at the local church. In 1948, Gaines rejoined his mother in Vallejo, California, where she had found work in California's great post-World War II economic boom. He discovered the downtown Carnegie Library and plundered it for books with 2 necessary qualities. Number 1, they had to be about the South, and 2, they had to be fiction. The 1950s ushered Gaines from high school to junior college, to an army tour in Guam, to college back in California, and finally into the writer Wallace Stegner's prestigious creative writing program at Stanford, where classmates included Wendell Berry and Ken Kesey. He won the Joseph Henry Jackson Award for A Novel in Progress. That novel developed into 1964's Catherine Carmier, followed 3 years later by Of Love and Dust, which coincided with a fellowship for Gaines from the National Endowment for the Arts. He broke through to a wider public with The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman in 1971, which was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. More well-received novels followed, including A Gathering of Old Men in 1983, shortly after the start of his years teaching writing at the University of Louisiana in Lafayette. There he conceived the idea for his 6th novel, A Lesson Before Dying, though a decade would pass before it saw print. A Lesson Before Dying, printed in 1993, surpassed even the rapturous reception accorded Miss Jane Pittman. A Lesson Before Dying is the heart-wrenching story of death and identity in a small Cajun Louisiana community in the 1940s. A young black named Jefferson is a reluctant party in a shootout in a liquor store in which the 3 other men involved are all killed, including the white store owner. Jefferson, the only survivor, is accused of murder. At the trial, the essence of the defense is that the accused, a lowly form of existence, lacking even a modicum of intelligence, is incapable of premeditated murder. His lawyer argues, "Why, I would just as soon put a hog in the electric chair as this," but Jefferson is condemned to death. Grant Wiggins, who left his small rural black community to go to university, has returned to the plantation school to teach children whose lives promise to be not much better than Jefferson's. But he wonders whether he has the will to take off north or west, like so many more before him, who knew it was the only way to climb out of a centuries-old rut. He is grappling with his own situation when Jefferson's godmother and Grant's aunt persuade Grant to impart something of himself, of his learning and pride, to Jefferson before his death, to prove the lawyer wrong. A Lesson Before Dying tells the story of these two men who, through no choice of their own, come together and form a bond in the realization that sometimes simply choosing to resist the expected is an act of heroism. Ernest Gaines brings to the novel the same rich sense of place, the same deep understanding of the human psyche, and the same compassion for a people and their struggles that have informed his previous, widely praised novels. And we have an excerpt from an interview of Ernest Gaines. On August 16, 2007, Dan Stone of the National Endowment for the Arts interviewed him at his home in Pointe-Coupée Parish, Louisiana. Stone asks, "When did books first become important to you?" Gaines, "As a child in Louisiana, there was no library that I could go to. But when I went to California, I found myself in the library. And at age 16, I started reading and reading." Stone, "What experiences from your own life did you work into A Lesson Before Dying?" Gaines, "The first 6 years of my education were in my plantation's church, and I used that as Grant's school. We worked and picked pecans to buy our clothes, and we went to school about 5.5 months of the year because we had to work in the field at age 8, from mid-March until about mid-September." Stone, "It's assumed that Jefferson is innocent, but in the beginning this is never stated. Did you intentionally give two sides?" Gaines, "I don't know whether he's innocent or guilty. The point of the story is how two men would grow to become real men. Jefferson with only a few months to live, Grant with another 40 years or more to live. What will they do with that time? Neither one is going anywhere in life. Grant wants to get away. Jefferson is just there, doing whatever people want him to do. He never argues. He never questions anything. I wanted the story to be about how both men develop." Stone, "Grant gives Jefferson a radio. How is music able to break down those barriers?" Gaines, "Music is very important to me. When I was growing up, there were maybe one or two radios in the quarters here. We'd listen to the music at my grandmother's house, especially late at night when we could hear the blues. It is the blues that reaches Jefferson spiritually. The minister tried to reach him, but I think he was closer to those old blues. So the purpose of the radio was to get Jefferson to open up." Stone, "Why is Grant so unable to help Jefferson at the beginning of the novel? What is his deepest struggle?" Gaines, "Grant is struggling with the South at that time. This man was terribly angry. He didn't know who he was, and that's the worst thing in the world that can happen to a man. He hated where he was, but at the same time, he can't leave. I don't know what would have happened to me had I stayed there. I probably would have ended up teaching in a little school and angry the rest of my life. So the two best moves I've ever made in life were the day I went to California and the day I came back here. My folks took me away from here in 1948, and then in 1963 I came back here." Stone, "The California poet Robinson Jeffers wrote about something called the inevitable place, that some people are tied to a place where they inevitably have to return. They can go anywhere in the world, but that's the spot for them. It seems Louisiana is that place for you." Gaines, "Definitely so. I tried to write about the Army and the year I spent in Guam. I tried to write ghost stories about San Francisco. I can't write about San Francisco, but I can write about that little postage stamp of land in Louisiana. In my case, the body went to California. The soul remained here with my aunt and my brothers and sisters and friends in the old shack where we lived." And now a few random quotes from Gaines. He says, "Why is it that as a culture, we are more comfortable seeing two men holding guns than holding hands?" Nietzsche said, "Without music, life would be a mistake." To me, without books, life would be a mistake. There will always be men struggling to change, and there will always be those who are controlled by the past. You've got to bend with the wind, or you're broken. Everything's been said, but it needs saying again. Sometimes you got to hurt something to help something. Sometimes you have to plow under one thing in order for something else to grow. Anytime a child is born, the old people look in his face and ask him if he's the one. The artist should be like a heart surgeon. He must approach something with sympathy, but with a sort of coldness, and work until he finds some kind of perfection in his work. You can't have blood splashing all over the place. Things must be done very cleanly. And finally, we've only been living in these ghettos for 75 years or so. But the other 300 years? I think this is worth writing about. I think we've made tremendous sacrifices. We've shown tremendous strength. In the ghetto, you see a lot of frustration. You see very little strength. That's all the time we have for today's readings from Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at triangleReadingService.org. I will repeat both of those at the end of this broadcast. Once again, I'm Kurt Benrud. Our readers, Tom Haynes, Pam Vesper, Robbie Merritt, Awen Fulton, and Dan and Julie Oliver, thank you for listening. The music was supplied by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. Our phone number once again is 919-832-5138. Our web address once again is triangleReadingService.org.